Sigurol, standing a short distance away, his gaze locked on the bull with the kind of concentration that only came from use of black.
That's the truth.
Clay got to his feet, unslinging the coiled rope from his shoulders.
Probably should have thought of this in the first place.
He leapt onto the bull's back, swiftly looping the rope over its neck before the elevated angle caused him to slip off.
All right,
he told Sigurol, who nodded and withdrew his black before wisely retreating several yards. The bull let out a strange sound as it settled onto all four legs. It was somewhere between a sigh and a whinny, and spoke of a deep, primal distress. Clay had expected it to buck or stamp, but true to his uncle's word, it just stood there, its sighs becoming more shrill by the second.
Easy, big fella,
Clay said, smoothing a hand along the beast's leathery hide. The bull twitched in response, craning its head to view the thing on its back with wide, fearful eyes. Clay continued to try and soothe it without much success, before it occurred to him he had no notion of how to get it to move.
Lay the rope on the right side of his neck,
Braddon said a short while later.
Gentle-like, no need to whip him.
Clay did as he said, the muscles of the bull's right shoulder shuddering in response as the animal shifted to the left. It came to a halt when he removed the rope from its hide. Clay tried the same trick with the left side with similar results.
Lay it on his rump to get him to walk, Braddon said. A couple of taps and he'll run, but don't try that just yet. Gotta get the rest of them in line.
The other Serath continued to stand a short way off, voicing sighing whinnies of distress, but displaying no sign of any violent action. It was as if the immobility of the bull cast some sort of spell over them, robbing them of their will. A few grew skittish as the rest of the company approached, some shying away. At Braddon's direction, Lieutenant Sigurol used black to hold a chosen few still long enough for them to be mounted, and the gear securely strapped in place.
Compass bearing, if you please, Lieutenant,
Braddon said once they had all mounted up.
East-northeast.
Sigurol rode behind Loriabeth, who had hold of the reins on their Serath, a young male only a few inches shorter than the bull. Unlike the herd leader, however, this beast was prone to continually turning about, so it took a while for the lieutenant to get a compass bearing.
That way,
he said finally, pointing towards a stretch of open plain.
Once he starts, he won't stop till he's tired,
Braddon called to Clay.
And that may take a good long while, so hold tight.
It took Clay a few minutes to maneuver the bull into position, the rest of the herd growing more agitated as he did so. Once he was reasonably sure the beast was facing the required direction, Clay slapped the rope twice against his rump, whereupon the bull let out a throaty roar of alarm and spurred into a gallop. Clay gave an involuntary laugh of exhilaration as the Serath sped across the grasslands. Its speed far outstripped that of any horse he had ever ridden, and the joy of acceleration came close to matching the feeling of riding atop Lutheron's back. A thunder of hooves caused him to look over his shoulder, to be greeted by the sight of the rest of the herd following, the earth seeming to tremble as they raced to keep up with their leader. Dust rose high enough to obscure the sun, so that it felt like they were galloping through a foggy void. Clay turned his gaze to the front, where the plain stretched away like a yellow-green sea. Taking a firm grip on the rope coiled about the bull's neck, he wondered if it might have been a good idea to drink some more green before setting off. Chapter 17. Lizanne. Lizanne blinked and found herself back in the hold, Macario retreating from her in surprise and lowering the mirror he had been holding close to her mouth.
Checking for breath, he said. You were gone a long time.
Lizanne realized she had been placed on a bunk and concluded she must have collapsed. Usually a blood-blessed would remain in the same seated pose whilst trancing. This one had evidently been different.
Jemiah, Tekela, and her father stood close by, all staring at her with worried faces. Lizanne swung her legs off the bunk, groaning a little at the lingering fog in her head. The artisan's trance had been the deepest and most vibrant she had experienced, and leaving it rather felt like stepping from one world to another.
"Are you all right?"
her father asked, moving closer to place a hand on her forehead.
"Your temperature's low. I'll fetch Dr. Weygrand."
"I'm fine," she said, trying to swallow and finding her mouth dry.
"Some water would be nice, though."
"I'll get it,"
Tekela said, immediately scampering off. Seeing Tinkerer on the next bunk, Lizanne reached out to grasp his arm, giving it a gentle shake.
"Do you remember anything?" she asked.
Tinkerer gave no response, continuing to lie still, eyes closed. Lizanne took his hand, finding it cold, and seeing that his chest was barely moving.
"I think you'd better get the doctor after all," she told her father. "Some form of comatose state,"
Dr. Weygrand said a short while later,
"but of a kind I've never seen before."
He had conducted a full examination of the artificer, pronouncing his condition stable but unresponsive. Attempts to wake him with smelling salts or prods from a small but sharp needle to the soles of his feet had produced no reaction. The doctor sighed, running a hand through his thinning hair.
"I'll need to transfer him to the medical bay, rig up an intravenous drip to ensure he doesn't dehydrate. I can add some stimulants to the mix, which might wake him up."
"No,"
Lizanne said.
"He's waiting," she realized. "Or rather, she's waiting. Pumping drugs into his veins could disrupt his memories."
"Thank you, Doctor," she went on. "But I believe he's best left unmedicated for now. However, I can't stress enough how important it is that he remain alive."
"It's important for me that all my patients remain alive, miss,"
Weygrand replied.
"Of course."
She smiled and gestured for Macario to follow her to a secluded corner of the hold.
"The Follies of Savokas," she said. "Does it mean anything to you?"
"It's a comic opera," he said, "dating back to the Third Imperium. Savokas was a possibly fictional explorer of the Eratian continent, I know. The tales of his exploits are classics of Corventine literature. And the basis for the Follies, it's a fairly minor work, but highly popular in its day. It does seem a little vulgar for the artisan's tastes. He strikes me as a more discerning fellow."
"She," Lizanne corrected. "And she made it clear that we need to study the Follies of Savokas. I believe there's another movement to the composition, something that will unlock further memories from her chosen vessel."
Macario glanced back at Tinkerer, silent and pale on the bunk.
"So he'll remain like this until we come up with the next movement?"
"I think so."
The musician pursed his lips, frowning deeply, presumably as archaic tunes played in his head.
"I'll need to reconstruct the opera from memory. It'll take a while."
Catching sight of her father returning to his workbench, Lizanne started towards him.
"Tekela might be able to help," she told Macario. "She does seem to have a facility for such things." "And an equal facility for getting on my bloody nerves," he added. "Time is a factor," she reminded him before joining her father.
He was engaged in an improved version of the aerostat's blood burner, a new feed mechanism that would enable product to be combusted in batches rather than all at once.
"Tinkerer's rocket," she said. "Do you think you can finish it?"
Captain Trumaine's course guided the fleet in a wide arc around Iskemir Island, keen to limit any contact with Verestian vessels during the voyage. They saw a few merchantmen over the course of the next few days, but none felt the need to investigate such a large formation of foreigners. It was only when they made the westward turn towards Blaska Sound
that a flotilla of fast sloop-class ships appeared on the northern flank of their convoy. A few hours later, another flotilla of similar size appeared to the south. The Verestian ships maintained a consistent distance from the fleet, making no attempt at communication. "Making sure we don't change our minds," Trumaine concluded after the second flotilla appeared. He tracked his spyglass along the line of Verestian vessels, grunting in grim recognition. "Pirates, the lot of them. That one in the lead is the Iron Spike. Chased her all the way around the southern barrier isles a few years ago. The captain kept throwing his cargo away to increase speed. After a while, we started finding the bodies of his crew. He couldn't have had more than a half dozen men left by the time a storm brewed up. Had hoped the bugger had foundered in it." Blasca Sound came into view the next morning, a mist-shrouded estuary about 3 miles wide. The passage was further constricted by a series of granite reefs that prohibited any rapid maneuvering. Trumaine signaled one of the smaller ships to lead the way, a one-paddle mail packet of aged appearance, but with a veteran captain renowned for his navigational skills. The Viable Opportunity took up station a mile to the east, circling slowly with all hands at battle stations. Trumaine maintained a rigid vigilance over their Verestian escorts as the fleet made its way into the sound, calling out the range to each ship for the ensign at his shoulder to note down. Lazanne felt there to be a certain theatre in all of this, Trumaine putting on a show to bolster the nerves of his crew. However, he must have known that whilst the Viable was a formidable ship, if the Verestians chose to attack, she would be overwhelmed in short order. "Looks as if your employers are keeping their end of the bargain," he said, lowering the spyglass as the last of the refugee vessels proceeded into the sound. "For now, at least. Helm, steer 40 points to port. Mr. Tolber, signal the engine room to take us to 1/3 speed."
"What a divinity-forsaken dump," Takela observed, as the Viable weighed anchor off Raker's Mount.
The place consisted of a loose arrangement of dilapidated hovels clustered around a series of hill-sized slag heaps. The mine itself was a gaping black hole, gouged into the slope of the mountain that loomed over the town. An incline railway line led all the way from the mine to the docks, which were the only truly impressive feature the settlement had to offer. 5 piers jutted out from the quay, which had been constructed atop a granite shelf that became a cliff at low tide. Consequently, the piers had been built on tall supporting legs of iron, each one streaked with rust. It was a testament to the sturdiness of their original construction that the piers were still standing after so many years of neglect. The steam-driven elevators that had once conveyed cargo and crew from moored vessels to the docks were apparently rusted to uselessness. Therefore, the fleet had been obliged to wait for high tide before disembarking the refugees. They were crowding onto the quayside in increasing numbers, most standing around in groups which reflected the ship they had spent so many weeks aboard. A few had begun to drift into the town in search of shelter, but it was clear to Lazanne that a great deal of organization would be needed before these people could be called a workforce.
"You should have seen Skorazin, my dear," Macario told Takela. "This is a genteel spa town in comparison. Besides, I'll be happy just to feel solid ground beneath my feet again. I find myself heartily sick of a sailor's life." "If not the sailors," Takela muttered, earning a stern look from Lazanne. "It looks as if I'll have need of your secretarial skills once more," she told her. "I trust you can find a notebook somewhere." "I thought I'd take the Firefly up again," Takela said. "Have a scout around."
"Firefly?"
"The aerostat. I decided she should have a name."
"Very nice, I'm sure."
Lazanne turned and started towards the derrick, where Ensign Tolver was preparing a launch to take them to shore.
"But I'm afraid your aerial adventures will have to wait.
She paused as an angry murmur rose from the direction of the docks. Two of the refugee groups had begun to jostle each other, voices raised as pushes and shoves soon became punches and kicks.
"Be sure to bring a revolver along with the notebook," Lizan added. "I believe we're about to have a very trying day."
"We work or we starve."
The assembled crowd hushed as Lizanne's words swept over them. She stood atop a raised platform in what had once been a shed used to house the locomotive engines for the incline railway. It was the largest covered space in the town, and therefore a useful place for a general meeting. It also benefited from a scaffold of elevated walkways, where a number of riflemen from the Viable had been stationed. She was flanked on either side by Captain Trumaine and Madame Hackigan, and had hoped that the presence of the refugee fleet's leaders and the riflemen might moderate any discontent. At this juncture, however, the assembly seemed unimpressed and certainly not cowed. The hush that followed Lizanne's statement was soon replaced by a babble of discontented voices, rising in pitch and volume.
"We are not slaves!"
one woman near the front shouted, as she and a dozen others struggled against the line of sailors positioned in front of the platform.
"I have children!"
shouted another.
"Corporate bitch!"
added someone else. Lizanne pressed the first and third buttons on the spider and let loose with a blast of heated air, spread wide enough to prickle the skin but not set anything alight, along with a hard shove of black, which sent the refugees at the forefront of the mob sprawling.
"I apologize,"
Lizanne said, breaking the silence that followed. The crowd stared at her now, fear on most faces, but also plenty of defiance too.
"Clearly I did not introduce myself properly," she went on. "My name is indeed Lizanne Lethbridge, and I truly am a shareholder in the Iron Ship Protectorate. But I have another name, one I earned at Carvenport. They called me Miss Blood, and it was not a name I came by accidentally."
She paused, scanning the crowd. She was quite prepared to send a concentrated blast of black into the face of anyone who shouted another insult, but for now they seemed content to remain silent.
"At Carvenport, I organized a defense that saw thousands to safety," she said. "I did so because those people gave me their trust, as I gave them mine. So I ask you to trust me now, as I set out, in clear terms, the reality of our current circumstance. We have been provided with this haven, ugly as it is, not because our hosts desire our company, or because their hearts are swollen with compassion at our plight. We exist here because I promised them weapons. You will make those weapons. If you do not, the best we can expect from our hosts is to be told to leave. I don't think you need a great deal of imagination to deduce what the worst will be."
She allowed a few seconds to let the information settle, seeing a measure of defiance slip from some faces and the fear deepen on others.
"But know that the weapons we will construct here will not just be for our hosts," she continued. "Sooner or later, an army of monsters will come for us, and there will be no corner of the world left in which to hide. Running before this storm is no longer an option. I told you we work or we starve, and that is true. What is also true is that we fight or we die."
She let the subsequent silence string out, hearing a murmur of tense discussion, but no more shouts.
"This facility will be run in accordance with corporate law," she said, adopting a brisk managerial tone. "With the addition of certain provisions in the Protectorate Disciplinary Code, desertion will be punished by death. Shirking work will be punished by reduction of rations. Repeat offenders will be flogged. Every adult of fighting age will receive 2 hours military training a day. Creches and schools will be organized for the children."
She pointed to the rear of the shed,
where Ensign Tolva and a group of sailors had begun to set up a row of tables.
"Please form orderly lines. Provide your name, age, previous work history, and any useful skills. Any blood-blessed will also make themselves known. We will be conducting a bloodlot eventually, so if you have the blessing, there's no point trying to hide it."
"A little to the left,"
her father called from atop the scaffold. Lizanne injected an additional measure of black and concentrated her gaze on the bulbous steel container she had maneuvered onto the 20-foot-tall bottle-shaped brick chimney. There were several such chimneys scattered about the town, usually found in proximity to the slag heaps. Lizanne had initially seen little of interest in them, so was surprised by her father's enthusiasm for what he called coking ovens.
"Stop!"
he called, waving his arms. Lizanne halted the flow of black, and the container settled onto the chimney top with an ugly groan of metal on brick.
"Excellent,"
he said, then called on his assigned group of workers to start shoveling coal into the aperture in the chimney's base. Once the oven had been filled, he turned expectantly to Lizanne.
"I think this would go quicker if you would," he said, gesturing at the spider.
Lizanne moved to crouch at the aperture, injecting a dose of red before concentrating her gaze on the mass of coal. She stepped back as a deep red glow blossomed in the pile, then jerked aside as the whole thing burst into fiery life, the jet of flame coming close to singeing the sleeve of her overalls.
"Close it up,"
the professor commanded, and a laborer came forward with a long iron pole to secure an iron door over the blazing aperture. Lizanne climbed the scaffold to peer over her father's shoulder as he stared at a dial fixed to a valve in the container's side.
"It's working,"
he said, as the dial's indicator began to inch upwards.
"We have ourselves a gas plant."
"Coal gas will work as well as helium?" she asked.
"It doesn't have quite the same lifting power, but we can compensate for that with an expanded envelope. It does benefit from being less flammable than hydrogen, but given that we have neither helium nor hydrogen, there seems little alternative in any case."
The sound of a ship's siren drew Lizanne's gaze to the docks. She could see men running to their stations on the deck of the viable opportunity, whilst smoke blossomed from her stacks. The reason for the commotion soon became clear, as she saw a sleek Verestian sloop approaching from the eastern stretch of the sound. She was flying a truce flag, but it seemed Captain Tremaine wasn't willing to allow the Viable to remain at her mooring with a potential threat so close.
"Our hosts have decided to pay us a visit," she said.
"Good," her father said. "I hope they brought some copper."
"Did you know?"
Arshav O'Canus glared at her with dark, angry eyes. He had arrived on shore with a 10-man escort, led by the perennially stern of face Mr. Lockbar. Lizanne decided to meet Arshav with a squad of riflemen under Ensign Tolva's command. The two groups eyed each other across the wharf, whilst Lizanne stepped forward to offer her employer the most polite greeting she could muster. Today, however, conversational niceties didn't seem to concern him.
"Know what?"
she inquired, resisting the urge to flex her fingers over the spider's buttons. This man had a tendency to lead her towards unwise impulses.
"Melkorin," Arshav said. "It's been burned to the ground and most of its population appears to have vanished. Those that aren't lying dead in the streets, that is."
Melkorin, a port town on the South Corventine coast. The thought immediately led her to an obvious conclusion. It followed us.
"Strange that this should happen shortly after you arrive in our waters,"
Arshav went on, a snarl creeping into his voice.
"Quite the coincidence, don't you agree?"
She considered dissembling, professing ignorance or confusion, but didn't see the point at this juncture. The suspicion born on the deck of the profitable venture, when the spoiled boarding party began their coordinated attempt to kill her,
now seemed fully borne out. "The White is desirous of my death," she said, "and the deaths of those I travel with. I did warn you its forces would be coming here."
"Not so soon, you didn't!"
His voice had risen to a shout, causing her escort of riflemen to stir, which in turn had Arshaf's pirates reaching for their weapons.
"All right," he said,
waving a hand at Lochbar and making an effort to calm himself.
"Why does it want you dead?"
he asked, in a marginally more controlled tone. "That," Lizan said, turning away and gesturing for him to follow, "is quite a lengthy tale. Best shared over lunch."
"Crystalline Lake," Arshaf said, shaking his head and reaching for the wine bottle. "Father's mad obsessions return to plague me once more."
He poured himself a generous measure and offered the bottle to Lizan. "No, thank you."
"Captain Noose?"
Arshaf asked, waving the bottle at Trumaine, who sat opposite him. Lizan had organized the meal in the only dwelling in Raker's Mount that might be called Grand. It was a three-story house positioned at a decent remove from the rest of the town, proclaimed as the home of the Imperial Comptroller by the Eutherian letters carved above the lintel. The roof was mostly gone, the windows long vanished, and the place smelled strongly of rot, but it did feature a dining table complete with chairs.
"No,"
Trumaine replied, returning the enmity in Arshav's gaze in full measure.
"Suit yourself."
Arshav set the bottle down and took a deep drink from his glass.
"Piss water," he said with a grimace. "Don't you people know how to greet an honored guest?"
"Crystalline Lake," Lizan said.
"Oh yes, where your friends are off looking for father's fabled treasure. It's all nonsense, you know. Ancient scribblings sold to generations of gullible fools, much of them fake, I'm sure."
"We have reason to believe otherwise. There is something at the bottom of that lake that can help us win this war. If your father told you anything..." Arshaf laughed and drained his glass.
"I mostly remember him telling me to get out of his sight. I was as much a disappointment to him as he was to me. So no, my dear Miss Blood, I have no secrets to share. Anything of use will be at the High Wall, and I am not welcome there."
His gaze darkened, fist tightening on the wine bottle.
"Even though it's mine by right."
"The High Wall is the seat of the O'Canis family, is it not?" Lizan asked. "It would seem strange that you and your mother were able to assert control over the ruling council and the Seven Walls, but not your family home."
"A home stolen from me by my own kin."
His gaze softened a little, and he poured more wine, grimacing as he emptied the bottle before throwing it over his shoulder.
"Perils of being born into a family of pirates, I suppose. The bastards will steal the gold from your teeth if you're not careful. My dear cousin, Alzar Lacaris, firstborn son to my late Aunt Kezia, now holds the High Wall. Supposedly in my sister's name, as if she's about to appear on the horizon any time soon."
"Will he be amenable to negotiation? Perhaps if I went..."
"He'll shoot you the moment he claps eyes on you. Hates all things corporate, you see? Almost like a religion, really."
Arshav's gaze swiveled to Trumaine.
"But it's not like you didn't give him plenty of reason, Captain. He lost a lot of sea brothers to your attentions, as did I."
He drank more wine, gulping it down so that some leaked from the corners of his mouth.
"Was going to kill you, you know,"
he gasped when the glass was empty.
"Had it all planned. Once you'd settled in here and gotten all comfortable, I'd turn up with all my ships and threaten to pound the town to pieces, just like you intended to do to the Hive. Then I was going to hang you on your own deck, you vicious fuck!"
He slammed the wine glass down on the table, hard enough to shatter it, blood leaking from his fingers as he glared at Trumaine. Lazanne found herself impressed by the captain's failure to flinch. Martinet or not, he was still a veteran protectorate officer, and Arshav his long-standing enemy, fully deserving of justice. Trumaine said nothing, instead reaching for a napkin to dab away the drop of wine on his cheek. Lazanne began to speak, but Arshav held up his bloodied hand, turning his baleful gaze from Trumaine to her.
Your fables and doomed friends trekking through the interior mean nothing to me. We have a war to fight, and my mother and I want our weapons. How soon before you actually start producing anything?
We need materials.
They're being unloaded now. Everything on your list, just about, and enough food for a month. There'll be more coming by the end of the week. How long?
We're already making progress, Lazanne lied. In fact, most of the workforce's efforts since arriving in Raker's Mount had been directed towards making the place fit for habitation. Lazanne had placed Madame Hackigan in charge of civil matters, and the former comptroller had done a great deal to smooth the ruffled nerves in the wake of Lazanne's speech. The former members of the Eastern Conglomerate levies had been organized into a militia that also served as a constabulary, which did much to imbue the town with a sense of order. Jemiah was organizing the principal manufactory in the old railway shed, but as yet, no actual weapons had been produced. Lack of heavy plant is a problem, Lazanne said. Especially lifting gear. We've identified only 3 other bloodblessed amongst the refugees. To make maximum use of their abilities requires product, especially black and red.
Product is an increasingly scarce resource, Arshav replied. For obvious reasons, and what stocks we do have will be needed by our own bloodblessed when the fighting starts. But, he gave a reluctant shrug, there are a few flasks in my ship's safe. You can have that.
That would be greatly appreciated.
I notice you haven't answered my question.
A month, she said,
adopting her uncolored tone.
The first delivery of growlers and thumpers will be made 1 month from now.
You think our enemy will give us that long?
It was Trumaine who answered, neatly folding his napkin and setting it down before addressing Arshav in a carefully modulated voice, no doubt designed to conceal his distaste.
Time in war is not given, he said. It's bought with blood. I command the fastest ship in these waters. Letting it sit here unused is a waste of a valuable asset. Want to take the fight to them, eh?
Arshav grunted.
Feel free, Captain. I'll spread the word that your ship is to remain unmolested. Just don't expect any direct assistance.
He looked at his bloodied hand and grimaced in annoyance.
And if you should contrive to get yourself killed in the process, all the better.
He rose from the table, fixing Lazanne with a hard stare.
1 month, Miss Blood, and when I return I expect to find a fulsome level of productivity.
With that he turned and stalked from the building, shouting for Lockbar and his guards to follow. Lazanne gave Trumaine a sidelong glance. Do you really think you can accomplish anything useful with just one ship? However fast.
Your father was kind enough to share the specifics of his latest design, Trumaine replied with a thin smile. Providing it's ready before we set off. Yes, I believe we can accomplish a great deal.
This is foolish, her father said. You are needed here. Lazanne fastened the buttons on her overalls. They were the work of a seamstress from Lossamark, lined with fur to ward off the cold found at altitude, as well as featuring numerous additional pockets for tools and weapons. Jemiah had managed to produce another smoker for her, though on this trip she would have to do without the mini growler. Madame Hackigan has things well in hand, Lazanne replied, and the production line is nearly complete. The intelligence to be had at the high wall is too important to ignore. She pulled on a shoulder rig for her twin revolvers.
Are you close to completing Captain Trumaine's project?
Professor Lethbridge appeared unconvinced by her reasoning, and less than happy with the change of subject.
2 more days, he said, face dark with reproach. It would have taken longer, but we've been fortunate in having so many skilled instrument makers here. Lossiemouth was a port, after all, and sailors always need clocks and compasses.
Excellent, Lizanne said. When it's done, please concentrate your efforts on constructing more of these.
She nodded at the aerostat, bobbing gently in the wind, between the 2 mooring poles at the end of the pier. The Firefly had undergone considerable modification since the last flight, with a wider gondola that would allow her to switch places with Tekela during flight, and an envelope of greater size. An additional canister of pressurized coal gas had been fitted to the gondola, should they need to replenish it. The improved feed mechanism for the blood burner was also in place, though they had precious little product with which to fire it.
Any we build from now on will be warcraft, she added, capable of carrying as much firepower as possible.
I've already drawn up the requisite designs, he said.
Of course you have.
She pecked a kiss to the professor's cheek before starting towards the Firefly, the engine's propellers starting to turn as Tekela powered up the caloric engine.
I'll return in 4 days.
And if you don't?
He called after her, fighting to be heard above the growl of the engine.
Then at least you can consider our contract with the O'Canus family null and void.
2. The Burning Seas. From the Journal of Miss Luella Tythoncroft, Sonora, 21st Verellum, 1600, Company Year 211.
The successful management of a revolution, it transpires, requires neither military genius nor inspired leadership, nor great rhetoric. No. If there is one lesson I have learned over the course of the preceding weeks, it is that revolutions require, above all things, paper and ink, as well as presses with which to apply the latter to the former. I have no precise figures for the number of pamphlets, posters, handbills, one-sheet newspapers, and other sundry publications produced by the Voters' Rights Alliance since this all began, but it surely must run into many thousands by now. The doughty old Ale Bond Commodities Mark II press that had served the Voters' Gazette so well for several years eventually collapsed under the strain of it all. Had we not agreed on an alliance with the Printers' Guild during the early days of this upheaval, I doubt we would have achieved any measure of success in rousing the populace. But success, of course, is a relative concept. Having read the paragraph above, I find my tendency to ramble has once more come to the fore. It has been some time since I had the leisure to write in this journal, and so much has happened in the interval that it will take too long to document every particular here. So I am forced to summarize the principal events. True to my promise to Mrs. Fredabel Torcreek, the Voters' Rights Alliance shouldered most of the burden in housing the refugees from the Tyrell Islands. I must confess to operating in a haze of confused emotions for much of this time. Mrs. Torcreek's news about Corrick engendered as much doubt and consternation as it did joy. It appears he has actually sailed off to the southern ice cap in search of something glimpsed in a vision. Although a much more thoughtful man than many in his profession, Corrick was never one given to flights of fancy, and the notion that he might throw off protectorate shackles to pursue something so ephemeral, it seemed absurd to the point of impossibility. Mrs. Torcreek, however, had at least a partial explanation. My nephew drank the blood of White Drake, miss. Guess that makes a fella awful persuasive. Despite the doubts and unanswerable questions that threatened to befuddle my brain, I set myself to the task of aiding the refugees with all the energy I could muster. The minority who belonged to the managerial class were usually able to find relatives or friends to take them in, which left the much less fortunate majority homeless without a script to their name. Many voter families volunteered to provide foster homes for the distressingly high number of orphans, whilst others gave over spare rooms and attics to the few intact families to disembark the ships. Even so, the Alliance was forced to rent warehouse space to house the remainder. Wild speculation in the markets has had a strange effect on the warehouse district. Some remain full to capacity with unwanted luxury goods, whilst those usually given over to agricultural produce and other necessities are increasingly empty. Consequently, finding a suitable location at a reasonable price was not difficult. The large number of sick and wounded presented a far greater problem. All but a few independent hospitals in Sonora are under corporate control, and, since none of the refugees could provide an insurance certificate, their doors remained firmly closed to us. As might be expected, many of the refugees with sick or injured relatives reacted badly to this, especially those hailing from Carvenport, who, on the whole, display only a small regard for corporate authority. A minor riot erupted at the gates of the Iron Ship General Hospital, which degenerated into an ugly free-for-all when the constabulary arrived. More trouble might have broken out if aid hadn't come from an unexpected quarter. The day after the riot, my father arrived at the Gazette offices with a letter of credit amounting to some 100,000 in exchange notes. Thanks to this donation, the Alliance was able to secure all the required beds in the independent Sonora hospitals. I will confess to a few private tears following this incident, my emotions being so aggravatingly variable at this juncture. The fact that my father's intervention had been completely unsolicited, and I am aware that accumulating such a sum would have required him to liquidate a large portion of his personal assets, still brings a certain moistness to the eye. In all, over 7,000 people were successfully provided with shelter, food and medical care within 2 days of arrival in this port. I should record that all this was achieved without any assistance whatsoever from the Iron Ship Syndicate. The few managerial representatives with whom I secured a meeting provided only empty platitudes and reminders of the wider crisis facing the entire globe. If anything, their demeanor was mostly one of irritation, as if the need to provide succor to thousands of dispossessed souls was a mere diversion from the real issue. Over the years, the Voters' Rights Alliance has maintained contacts with various sympathetic persons employed within the corporate structure. I wouldn't go so far as to describe them as covert agents, more a small number of individuals disenchanted with their employers and occasionally willing to part with relevant information. One such person, who I shall name only as X, met with me in the aftermath of yet another fruitless approach to the interim board to impart a singular and important fact. "The Iron Ship Syndicate is bankrupt," X told me. I had chosen a quiet corner in a secluded tavern for our meeting, and was obliged to lean across the table to hear, the words being so softly spoken. "Bankrupt?" I asked, finding myself suddenly lacking comprehension. I knew the meaning of the word, but placing it in conjunction with the wealthiest single entity in the world was momentarily disorientating. "What exactly do you mean?" "I mean they have no money." X is not a character given to overt emotion, so it was disconcerting to take note of a tremulous voice and twitching hands. "The company reserves are exhausted. There is no money to pay the workers in the manufactories. No money to pay the protectorate soldiers. No money to pay the managers, executives, or clerks. They've been printing scrip by the bucket load, but it's only a matter of time before a finance house attempts to convert a substantial amount of scrip into exchange notes or gold, and discovers they hold nothing more than a pile of worthless paper." I must confess to a certain hesitation before asking my next question. Although I had spent much of my adult years longing for the fall of the Iron Ship Syndicate, the apparent reality of just such an outcome was sobering, to say the least. The Alliance had always campaigned for a peaceful transition to representative government and regulated markets, but the sudden collapse of the world's greatest corporation would herald an era likely to be anything but peaceful. In all honesty, I wasn't sure I wanted it to be true. Nevertheless, I buttressed my resolve and asked the question anyway. You have proof of this? In response, X handed over a weighty stack of financial ledgers, all marked secret, bored eyes only, and all showing a zero in the total column. How could this happen? I asked. Product. X let out a laugh at this point, somewhat shrill and rich in despair. It was all built on product. Take that away, and what is Iron Ship? Just a collection of offices, ships, and manufactories, all soon to stand empty. And it's not just the syndicate. The chairman of the Ale Bond Commodities Board committed suicide 2 days ago, after being presented with a summation of the company accounts. Yesterday, South Seas Maritime issued an order forbidding any of its ships from leaving port, for the simple reason that they have no funds to buy coal or red to fire the engines. X gave another near-hysterical laugh, which soon faded, their features sagging into the pallid mask of a defeated soul. Now, if you'll excuse me, X said, rising from the table. I need to go home, dismiss all my servants, and tell my spouse they are married to a pauper, after which I suspect I shall get very drunk indeed. I made a slow return to the offices of the Gazette, clutching the ledgers tight and gazing around at all the people passing by. Despite recent troubles, there was still an air of normalcy to Sonora then. Stallholders still hawked their wares, boys still ran around delivering the intelligencer, and constables still strolled the thoroughfares, every one of them blithely unaware of the calamity that had already befallen their comfortable world. Upon returning to my office, I ignored the many calls for my attention, locking the door and spending several hours in silent contemplation of the stack of ledgers on my desk. The decision before me was stark, and, I decided in a fit of cowardice, not one I was prepared to make without counsel. Regardless of our short acquaintance, Mrs. Torcreek had proven herself to be one of the most level-headed and basically sensible individuals I had yet to meet. Also, her recent experience gave her a depth of insight beyond that of my immediate colleagues in the Alliance. Father knows more about corporate finance than anyone of my acquaintance, and was therefore far better attuned to the consequences of the act I was now forced to consider. Having answered my invitation, they both stood in silence as I related the news. Mrs. Torcreek reacted with a stoic lack of surprise and a sympathetic shrug. Trouble's gonna find everyone sooner or later, she said. That's the nature of the world right now. My father was notably less phlegmatic, removing his jacket to roll up his sleeves before spending over an hour in feverish examination of the ledgers. See us save us all, he breathed, closing the final one with a snap, resting his elbows on my desk as he rubbed at his temples. It's true. Iron Ship is ruined. I should like to relate that I immediately rose to my feet with a suitably impressive declaration regarding the duty of the press and the rights of the populace to be informed of such disastrous news. However, in actuality, I continued to sit behind my desk, staring at my father's stricken features as I asked in a small, frightened voice, "What do I do?" He stared at me for some time, long enough for me to take shocked notice of the tears welling in his eyes. Once, he began in a choked quaver, then paused, taking out a handkerchief and wiping his eyes. He coughed before continuing in a voice that actually sounded like my father. Once I would have implored you to wait, give me time to liquidize the family holdings.
and I'm sure you would have had many ugly things to say about my greed and selfishness, and perhaps you would have been right. Now, he rested a hand on the ledges, shaking his head. Now it doesn't matter. A disaster of this scale will take us all down with it, regardless of any action I take. Publish today or publish tomorrow, but publish. The world should know what's coming. Your pa's right, miss, Mrs. Torcreek put in. People got a right to know, and it's your job to tell them. Else, what are you doing here? Well, quite, I said, voice still small and hatefully weak. Taking a very deep breath, I rose to my feet, thanked them both for their advice, and opened my office door, calling loudly for an urgent editorial meeting. The following day, the headline of the Voters' Gazette read, Iron Ship Bankrupt, rendered in the largest lettering our print set would allow. The story beneath contained a detailed summation, compiled with my father's assistance, of the information in the ledgers provided by X. A battalion of Alliance volunteers spent several hours making copies of the ledgers, which were sent to the editor of the Intelligencer and every other periodical in Sonora. Copies were also dispatched by one of the few mail packets still operating to every major port in northern Mandanore. Although the Gazette's circulation has never been huge, the fact that this particular issue had been distributed for free guaranteed an initial readership of thousands. Our vendors were quick to demand more copies, and our available presses were soon producing issues as fast as could be managed. By the evening of that day, lengthy queues had appeared outside all of the major Sonora banks, as depositors demanded withdrawal of their funds. The fact that all but the first few dozen were turned away was all the proof the populace required to validate the Gazette's claim. The previously orderly crowds outside the banks soon became considerably less so. These were not the agitators and campaigners, often dismissed as extremists and malcontents by the corporations. These were ordinary people of many trades and occupations, all suddenly finding themselves impoverished through no fault of their own. Windows were broken, the doors to the banks battered down, and bank tellers forced to open vaults which were found to be mostly empty. Iron Ship's reaction was swift but, unfortunately, predictable. A nighttime curfew was declared. The Sonora garrison was turned out with orders to assist the constabulary in clearing the streets. They also made the singular mistake of sending a company of protectorate soldiers to arrest my good self and close the Gazette. The refugees, having been roused by Mrs. Torcreek, were more than happy to assist in establishing barricades in the surrounding streets. There are many stalwart souls amongst the refugees, some of them former contractors, hardened by numerous sojourns through the Aratian interior. Others are products of the notorious Covenport slums, and therefore habituated to use of weapons. Many of these people had contrived to retain ownership of their firearms, or found ways to purchase replacements since their arrival. Also, they were all unified, thanks to Mrs. Torcreek and the work I had done on their behalf, in a determination not to allow me to fall into protectorate hands. Consequently, the commander of the protectorate force bearing my arrest warrant found himself confronted by a series of fortified streets, bristling with guns, wielded by persons well acquainted with their use. Our defenses were also augmented by a significant number of Voters' Rights Alliance volunteers, veterans of many a protest who had armed themselves with clubs and piles of displaced cobblestones for use as projectiles. The protectorate captain, a resolute fellow, ordered his men to remain in ranks and approached our largest barricade alone, calling out a demand for my immediate surrender and a list of pertinent charges. Corporate libel, theft of syndicate property, conspiracy to disrupt public order. This litany of misdeeds ended abruptly when one Molly Pins, the clown-faced woman I had first met at the docks, fired a single pistol shot that shattered a cobblestone barely an inch from the captain's foot.
Get the F out of here, you syndicate P, Miss Pins advised to loud acclaim from her fellow defenders. And take those limp D's with you, lessen you wanna see 'em all dead. The captain, now somewhat white of face, barked an order that had his soldiers unslinging their rifles, although some began to hesitate when Mrs. Tallcreek added her own voice to the proceedings. They ain't paying you enough to die, boys, she called out, standing tall on the barricade. Fact is, they ain't paying you at all. Peering through a small gap in the barricade, I saw a few of the soldiers exchanging uncertain glances, whilst a number of others had failed to respond to their captain's order. Apart from the sergeants, they were all young, 18 or 19 for the most part, conscripts from the outlying holdings drafted only weeks or days before. However, most were dutifully bringing their rifles to port arms as their sergeants barked out their commands. It was clear that any chance to avoid this ending in violence was fast disappearing, and I had no desire to see anyone die on my account. Stop this, I said, scrambling up to stand alongside Mrs. Tallcreek. What are you doing, miss? She asked. I'm sorry, I can't let this happen. I turned to the captain, raising my arms above my head. He stared up at me in grim satisfaction as I opened my mouth to surrender, then saw his body crumple when one of his men shot him in the back. For perhaps 3 full seconds, nothing happened. The captain lay bleeding on the street. The soldier who had shot him stood frozen with smoke leaking from the muzzle of his rifle. The other soldiers all gaped at him or the captain's corpse. Then one of the sergeants raised his rifle and shot the soldier in the head. After that, everything happened very quickly. Get down, Molly Pins hissed, she and Mrs. Tallcreek forcing me back behind the barricade as gunfire exploded all around. The crack and snap of splintering wood accompanied the multitude of discharging firearms as bullets tore at the piled furniture that formed the barricade. Stop shooting, see ya, damn it! Mrs. Tallcreek yelled, a voice possessed of enough volume and authority to cause the surrounding refugees to cease their fusillade. They're fighting each other! A quick glance above the barricade confirmed her judgment. The Protectorate Company had split into 2 factions, both rapidly backing away from one another as they exchanged rifle shots, often tripping over the bodies of their comrades in the process. In the confusion, it was impossible to tell which group might harbor sympathy for our cause, although I did note that one was about 2/3 the size of the other. Also, the smaller group seemed to contain a number of sergeants, whilst the larger had none. After a few frantic minutes, the smaller group seemed to have fled, whilst the others remained, having taken cover in nearby doorways and alleys. A 6 soldiers lay on the cobbles, most unmoving, a couple twitching as they groaned. The renegade soldiers emerged from cover shortly after, led by a scrawny, hook-nosed youth with the broad vowels of the Marshwold. Not been paid for weeks, he said, nor fed much the last few days. Not like we volunteered, either. Most of us only got called up because our folk have got landhold contracts with Iron Ship. He went on to describe the widespread discontent amongst the ranks of the Sonora garrison, and alluded to the possibility that he could persuade more of his comrades to join. Join what? I asked, a question I have since recognized as singularly foolish. Why, the revolution, of course, miss, the scrawny youth told me. That's you, ain't it? Chapter 18. Hylemore. They're safely on the plains, Zenita said. Mr. Tallcreek thinks another 3 days until they reach the lake.
So soon? Hylemore asked in puzzlement. His examination of the charts relating to southern Aratzia left him with no illusions as to the distances involved.
Apparently a stampeding Seraph herd can cover 100 miles a day, she said. Seems a hazardous form of travel to me, but there you have it.
They were in his cabin, Zenita having just emerged from the regularly scheduled trial.